There's too many of you crying.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Hey, good morning to you, Calvin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great this morning, Earl. How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right, man. You heard the weatherman say we're going to get maybe in a couple days back up to the 30s. Yay! 30s. All right.
Better than nothing, I guess.
Yeah. On the line, Professor Bob Harvey. We had him on last Thursday. We've got him back. I'm so happy that he agreed to come back as we're closing out, Black History Month. And people, Professor Bob Harvey is a historian. He's not a black history historian. He's a historian of all sorts of different history, United States history, military history. Yeah, I don't know how many other different histories you are inclined to educate and teach people, Professor Harvey, and you've done this in different states and other places. But I want you to respond to the fact that we're going to make it up to 30 in a couple days.
Yeah, well, that's new. That's good news. I think right now we're in the 60s, but it's windy outside.
Oh.
So that means that it's knocking it down to about 50 because the wind velocity out here, and it's up to somewhere probably it's gusting between 20 and 40 miles per hour at times.
But it's at 60 degrees. Hey, Professor Harvey, you couldn't have lied a little bit, just a little bit.
No, the truth is crucial. I mean, no matter how much it hurts, believe it or not, truth hurts a lot. And that's one of the dilemmas that we face right now in this country, is that despite that, you've got people that are fighting it, kicking and screaming all the way.
So
let's create a false sense of narrative.
So let's do this, because we are going to talk about history, and nobody does it better than you. And when you hear people who still want to do away with history, it must make you cringe, since you've dedicated your life to chronicling and understanding history. What kind of thought process would you say to people who want to somehow just cast history away?
Well, people who have a sense of consciousness about them, they're going to always choose some path of history because they have to have a sense of from whence they came. All of us have that need. And it's kind of hard to know where you're going unless you understand from whence you came. And all people from all civilizations have gone through that process. Now, some more extensive than others. And those of us who engage in conversation about it, such as radio hosts and newspaper people, journalists, and the whole bit, we all ask those eternal questions. But the bottom line is that we all have to have a sense of history. Even people who may have mental illnesses, they have a sense of history. We just got to dig in and find out what it is. And people in power, one of the things that they have to do is create a narrative. A history, a sense of history that people can believe in. If they accept it, then they elect those people to power. And in order for them to stay in power, they have to keep that history alive, whether it's based on a lie or the whole bit. Every civilization in world history, going all the way back naturally to ancient times, you find out that leadership had to create a false sense of history to make themselves appear invincible or superior, or whatever, on other people to justify conquering and controlling them. The Romans, for example, a society, the only Western society that lasted for over 1,000 years, going all the way from a republic to an empire under the Caesars, they called everyone outside of Rome barbarians. they had to look down on them in order to feel superior. And for a while, that worked, and the people figured out that they could be beaten. You know, and ultimately, what destroyed the greatness of Rome was internal conflict. The same thing with Nazi Germany. Hitler had to create a false sense of greatness, you know, and create a history in order to get a whole nation of people behind him. And they did. They followed him blindly for his 12-year reign from 1932 to 1945. And when he finally collapsed, You know, a lot of people blame Hitler and his generals and Goering and Guderian and Meinstein and all those other individuals, Himmler. But at the same time, people believed him. They followed him blindly. Hitler could have never pulled off what he did in Nazi Germany if the people of Germany didn't support him. And I was reading an article the other night. In fact, I was watching television. I started off reading an article, and then I went ahead and looked at a strategic bombing movie, a movie about the bombing of Germany during World War II. And they were talking about it through the eyes of Bummer Harris, who was the commander of the RAF Bomber Command during World War II, where he believed in bomb the population, just area bombing. The United States tried strategic bombing, daylight bombing, but the British did it at night, and he believed in bombing the civilian population and what he called area bombing, and he got criticized for it. But his thing was, look what Germany did to other people, and the German people, doggone it, they knew about it, so they need to reap the wind that they had sown. And so what's good for the goose is good for the gander, so he bombed the hell out of them wherever he could to destroy Germany. And by 1945, by the time the Soviets took over Berlin, Bummer Harris, along with the United States and the round-the-clock bombing, bombed Germany into existence. And there were a lot of pilots, British and American, who felt guilty about what they were doing to the Germans in late 1945. But people like Harris stuck to his guns and said, you did it to us, now we're going to do it to you. This is total war. And so that's the kind of mindset that you have with people who think that they can do something, and then if someone else counters that they shouldn't do it, it's immoral. And I'm saying it, whether it's right or wrong, it's not the issue. It's dealing with the circumstances that are at hand and what led to those circumstances. So when I see history, I have to look at cause and effect. What causes people to do and think the way that they do? And you can apply that same logic to what happened. You know, there are a lot of people in this country who are disgruntled and fed up and angry with government. But I say to those individuals, if you don't vote, then you're guilty of not participating. And if you do vote, you're guilty of who you send to Washington to deal with it. And if you got people who, for example, you got these individuals right now who are Trumpsters who believe that the election was stolen, they're sending a bunch of deniers to Washington. And they're still complaining about they're not getting anything done there in Washington. Well, you sent people there to disrupt. You sent them there to do nothing but disrupt, and that's what they're going to give you. So who do we blame for all of this? And I say that it's a false narrative to go down the path to bang up and beat up on Donald Trump, to beat up on the Greens and all those other folk who are now in Washington, you know, just showing off. But at the same time, we have to look at the people who sent them there.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that, Professor Harvey. You know, I always say, you know, you look at people are still in all the things that Donald Trump is faced with today. There's still 35% of people who still support him, even though you look at all the stuff that he's done. And how can you support a man that you know is crooked? And even in the face of that, you say, well, you know, they're just railroading him, even though you know better.
Well, see, the thing is that he gives them something that they want, and that is he gives them And he's not giving them a relief in the poverty that they're in, because they're still poor. They're still just as poor as, you know, a lot of people say that blacks shouldn't vote Democratic, that, they, you know, that they're still poor at the end of the day. But if you feel good about something, then, you know, you're going to continue to support it. I mean, look at why people use drugs. You know, because if you ask them when they're going through the being an addict, they say because it makes me feel good for a few moments.
Right.
But it makes me feel good. So you keep using, even though you know it's going to lead you down the path to destruction, you don't care because it's an immediate relief. You know, one of the areas that I've always studied, even when I was doing, you know, extensive graduate work at the University of Wisconsin at Madison in the early 1980s, you know, in the American History Department. And you often wondered what led Southern whites to fight so hard and fight so well in the Confederate Army. Why? When the simple fact is that only about less than 10% of whites
owned slaves.
Owned slaves. Oh, they were a part of a family that owned slaves. Only a smaller percentage than that, maybe about 3%, actually owned the slaves. Just that they had wives and children that were inheritors of the institution. The majority of whites didn't. Why did they get out there and fight and die? And at the close of the American Civil War, those people were still in the same predicament that they were before the war started.
So Professor Harvey, you hold that thought, because we got to come back to that. We've got to go to a break. And you just hit upon a point that, you know, it's kind of even replicated today with people who want to support the billionaires in the face of all the things that they do, and they're struggling to rub two pennies together. Same kind of philosophy. Got to go to a break. Professor Bob Harvey is on the line. You can join us at 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Professor Bob Harvey. You know, Professor Harvey, you were explaining before we went to break about only 3% of Southerners owning slaves, and yet all of them were fighting. Those who were in the war and were fighting, putting their lives on the line, even though, you know, it didn't impact or affect them. You were explaining why.
Well, you know, when you look at it from the standpoint that, you know, why they did what they did, you have to go back to the time period before the Civil War in 1861. Because before the Civil War, the South was still one of the poorest parts of the country. Most whites lived in barely above, poverty, if that. But they still believed in supporting the institutions that promoted slaveocracy.
Well,
they still did it.
Was that because there was no industry there, Professor Harvey, that they were living in those conditions?
And that is true, that the type of industry. But think about the situation in slavery to show you just how blind many of those folks were. A lot of the work that would have normally been going to everyday white citizens in the South,
the slaves were doing it.
Was taken up by slaves,
right?
Because the slave they didn't pay him no salary. I mean, why would you go to a white blacksmith and pay him to do the work with the agricultural industry that he could use to sustain his family and probably get a decent living? Why would you go to him when you had the slaves to do it?
Right.
And you would think that with that process, that's what made many Southern whites hate the slave. But he had a love-hate relationship because the slave master had to be the culprit here. But he managed to switch it around and get that white, angry white person to blame and look down on the black person. That's why that slave, was a target. He was a main target. And then after the Civil War, and the thing that kept that white person at bay was the fact that that slave master had value in that slave. Keep in mind that in 1860, the largest economic commodity for the South was slaves. That was the best, biggest, and most expensive, investment. Following that was cotton, the staple crop of the South, from 1820 up to 1860. So when you read books like Eugene Genovese's The Political Economy of Slavery and The World of Slaveholders Made, he lays it out there for you that this was an economic thing that the master class, the slaveholding class, had to convince the majority of the white population to go along with that process. On the eve of the American Civil War in 1861, there were 11 million people living in the South that made up the 11 states that seceded from the Union, 11 million of them. Of that number, 4 million were black. Only about 100,000 of those were free in one form or the other. But the other 7 million, those were white. And of that number, about 1 million of them were associated with the institution of slavery. The rest of them were just everyday white folk. Yet when the call to arms came into play, and during the 4.5 years of warfare from 1861 to 1865, of that number, roughly about 1 million men, white men, fought for the Confederacy. Only about 2 to 3% of them were actually the commanders. And most of those commanders were slaveholders. They were the master class, but they got all the other folk to follow them into battle and to die by the truckloads.
So
just wiping them out, but they fought.
So, Professor Harvey,
gallantly. But
hold the thought, Professor Harvey. We got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll let you continue on the other side. 844-967-2789. Professor Bob Harvey, and we're in class. We'll be right back.
Collision, marriage or shagging, which way do we go? One of us must let the other know. By taking our time, we will work our problems out. Till death do we part, or as friends we'll begin.
Mind-blowing. said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you. Moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me. Other eyes smile tenderly. Still in the peaceful dreams I see.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. On the line, Professor Bob Harvey. Professor Harvey, let's go to David from Mequon. Hey, good morning, David. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hey, good morning, Earl. Good morning, Professor Harvey. Really quickly, I just wanted to expand on what he was just saying. But, you know, one of the reasons why the South was in the predicament that it was in was that if you think about Eli Whitney, who invented the cotton gin, I believe it was 1791, Professor Harvey, the North embraced the Industrial Revolution much earlier. It was much more productive, and the state of New York alone was wealthier than the entire South put together. It was very inefficient. The South, you know, was called the king of cotton. They did not embrace the technology of the day, and consequently, the North became a lot more prosperous and much more productive. And one of the things that people don't realize is that's why the North developed much quicker city-wise, because there was, you know, they were taking machinery, and where the South was using slavery, which is very unproductive for the amount of work that they were putting in. And consequently, you know, cotton was the biggest exporter for the South. And as the North, you know, continually got more efficient with it, that is where, you know, things start to realize that the South would have embraced what was going on in the North. I think we could have avoided all this to begin with. I'm not sure, but it certainly, I think, would have been much different. It had a huge impact, the Civil War in particular, because of we saw new technologies that came out, even with the war itself.
So David, hang on. Let's let Professor Harvey respond. Professor Harvey?
Well, a lot of that is true and accurate, but keep in mind that the number one economic product in the nation, not just in the South, but in the nation,
was slavery.
Was cotton. That's why they called it cotton was king. And Southern politicians would rail about that constantly. If you read the journals, the constitutional journals that the Congress had to file to give their reports and the committee discussions and the whole bit, you will find that the congressional records would show that the Southerners were brazen because they knew they had the number one economic product in the country. And it is true. You were right, David, to say that in the North, most of the textile factories were up North. That's why there were a whole lot of Northerners that did not want slavery to end. You know, we have to understand the seed of slavery in this country. Of the original 13 colonies that were set up in the 17th century, in this country, the original parent colony that started the United States of America eventually, all of them had slaves, every single one of them. And the first one to come along that didn't have it was Vermont, the 14th state that joined the Union after the Articles of Confederation were created in 1781. So let's understand that when Condoleezza Rice once said that slavery and racism was a part of America's DNA, she's absolutely right. So, yes, it is true that most of the textile factories are up North. But make no mistake about it, the other reason why the North took off is because they developed a wage-earning class, and they were constantly bringing in new blood of immigrants coming mostly from Europe at this time. And those individuals came over here looking for freedom and development. Remember, Wisconsin at one time had started off as a party consisting of what you call the free soilers. Free soilers meaning we didn't want slavery in our territory because it's counterproductive to our economic engine. We want wage earners, people that can buy the things that they make. The South had a closed society where the poor whites didn't have the money to buy anything. And the slaves certainly didn't have any money because it was, in many cases, it was against the law for them not only to read and write, but to earn a salary. So they had a closed society. And that's one of the reasons why they wanted to expand. Remember, in 1860, there were roughly about 31 countries, 31 states in the nation. 16 of them were so-called free states, and 15 were slave states. And the thing is there was new territory opening up in the Southwest. Remember the Mexican-American War? We gained all that territory from Mexico. And so the Southerners wanted to expand into those territories. And in the Compromise of 1850, they pushed the idea of what we call popular sovereignty. Let the people vote in those areas and decide whether they're going to have slavery or not. California even voted on a resolution like that. And they barely won against slavery. But when the South saw that Lincoln came in 1860, saying that it was okay to have slavery, but he did not want it to expand into the new territories out west. That's when the moment Lincoln was elected, South Carolina, followed by six other states, seceded from the Union, and they were later followed by Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. Those were the last four. Those 11 states made them the Confederate States of America. But it was based on the idea that Lincoln did not want slavery. He wasn't opposed to it. He just didn't want it to expand. So we keep in mind that when you look at it from a historical context, slavery was an institution that Southern whites felt they had to have in order to have a closed economy. And Lincoln felt that that was a killer in this country because slavery was a dying institution. Remember, by 1810, slavery was on the decline in this country because tobacco had been the number one economic product and the world's market had been flooded with tobacco. It wasn't producing the kind of money that the slaveholders needed. And then all of a sudden there was cotton, some of that stuff growing in the wild out in the fields. They decided that they had to get access to that, and they needed slave labor to do it. So slavery was reinvigorated to survive. And that's one of the things that led to the Civil War.
So
both sides. No, go ahead.
No, so, Professor Harvey, so from that perspective, in the way you are explaining this, why would people be so, in today's society, be so opposed to having this kind of conversation?
Because, Earl, people, you know, a lot of people don't want to understand exactly why they're feeling the way they're feeling. And many white Americans who feel that, well, we've already gone through a whole lot of things about race and the whole bit, so it's no longer relevant. It is relevant because we've never gotten over it in the first place. Remember, there are many people, not just in the South, but mostly in the South, but not just in the South. There are many whites who feel that, you know, they're still fighting the Civil War, especially in the South. I mean, I'm down here. I live down here. I was born and raised under Jim Crow. And what you have to do with those individuals who feel like they've been victimized is to say that a lot of the victimization that you have is on you, but the history is such that it digs their nerves. You see, what some of these politicians down south and Donald Trump is too stupid to understand what the word woke means, and the same is true with DeSantis. You don't know what the word woke means. But it's just because it really was a slang term started by black singers, and then, of course, picked up on by some other black scholars in the 1960s, the idea of woke being alert as to what's happening around you. Well, you know, people need to know what's happening to them.
Yes, and that's not a negative thing.
No, it's not. It's the willing and desire to learn the right, the truth. Because, you see, if you keep glossing over a lie long enough, people will begin to believe it. But at some point, if they ever wake up and they learn something different, things start to change. And that's the beauty of knowledge and the beauty of what I call inclusive history, where you teach the good and the bad. People can take what they want to out of it, but at least give it to them. But this new movement that they've got right now is designed to keep those people who believe in it asleep. And no matter what they see and what other people tell them, they're going to believe that nonetheless. Look at what that stunt that Donald Trump is pulling right now up there in Ohio. Now, Ohio was a state that went for Donald Trump. And what them people don't know in that Palestine and that small community is that it's Donald Trump who took the regulations off the railroad industry that would have led to safety, you know, inspections that may have avoided that conflict and that tragedy they're in right now. We all feel it, but it's one of those things where we lead them to a place where they're dead and in their sleep, and now Donald Trump is coming in and saying, "I'm gonna solve it for you and take care of everything.
Yes.
Boy, don't worry, I'll take care of it." He didn't take care of it while he was in office. And all those other politicians who believe that the election was stolen, those same people, he's coming back to try to steal the election again. And there are a lot of people who, no matter what happens, are going to engage in what Alpha Lord Tennyson made famous in this Charge of the Light Brigade, you know, where they're going to go down that valley. They know they're going to die, but they go anyway.
So,
and that's exactly what he's setting them up. He's not going to solve their problem for them.
So
he's not going to solve their problem because he doesn't have that solution.
So, Professor Harvey, the way you've laid out parts of why slavery existed initially and how it went in the direction that it went in the Civil War and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and all of these things and history that all of us need to know, then what happens when you hear, well, it makes our children feel bad?
Well, that's one of the dumbest arguments that anyone could ever make or anyone could ever believe. Because think about this, Earl. In 1971, when I was working on my master's thesis on blacks in the military, I looked at a lot of the census data. And when I went off to do postgraduate work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the 1980s, I did studied some more of the census data, because the census pretty much comes out every 10 years, as the Constitution states. But in some years, like in the middle of a decade, like in 1975, and in this case, it was 1975, and then again, I looked at it in 1965, there's special census data that deals with characters of the American people, looking at a profile.
So, Professor Harvey, hold the thought. We got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll let you continue that thought. 844-967-2789, Professor Bob Harvey. As only Professor Bob Harvey can do. We'll be right back.
Georgia, no peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Well, I think I'm going out of my head. Yeah. Yes, I think I'm going out of my head over you. Over you. I want you to want me. I need you so badly. I can't think of anything. Explain the tears that I shed over you, over you. I see you each morning, but you just...
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Professor Bob Harvey is on the line. You know, Professor Harvey, before we went to break, I was asking you about why this group of people who wanted to revisionist history led by Ron DeSantis, and they didn't want their children to feel bad about the history of slavery. And you say what to that?
Well, Earl, the thing is that, and I was talking about the census data that I had researched for some major research papers, and I remember looking at the data, and I was shocked when I looked at the ethnic breakdown. Most of the census data deals with race and religion and sex, but they don't deal with ethnicity. Well, this precious special study in 1975 did do that, and then I read across that study and along with some others, and I was shocked to realize that two of the largest Euro-American populations in the United States, one of the largest immigrant groups that trace their ancestry back to Western Europe, were German Americans, which Milwaukee is, and Wisconsin is a classic example of it, especially Milwaukee, which was the epicenter for German ancestry. And then the other was Italian American. And, you know, usually when you're doing research, extensive research about anything, you normally find yourself doing research beyond what your paper is going to be about. And so you just hang on to that data and then try to apply it to some other questions that you have about some segments of American history. For example, the resistance to America going to war. It happened in World War I and World War II, but especially World War II. Why was there so much opposition to going to war? Remember, people were raising hell about going to war, and Roosevelt, in order for him to win the election in 1940, saying that he was not going to send any American boys, you know, to war. And Woodrow Wilson said the same thing, you know, in 1913. But they ended up having to change it. But the strong opposition came from those individuals of people of Irish descent, because the Irish had a strong hatred for the British. The Scottish did too. But Germans were expressly that way. And one of the strongest oppositions to going to war in the northern cities was, of course, coming from those individuals of German ancestry. I had a professor down at Madison who was a part of a Hitler youth group. He just came out, and I took one of my went in his office, and he just bluntly told me that they was a part of a Hitler youth movement, and that there was an active German-American bond right there in Milwaukee. That was the epicenter for it. So, you know, one understands that that gives you some answers as to why there was so much opposition. It took the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor for us to finally jump into the war. And keep in mind, we didn't declare war on Germany. Germany didn't declare war on us. We declared war on Japan. But because of the Rome-Berlin-Tokyo Axis agreement between Italy, Japan, and Germany in 1940, when they did that pact, they agreed to mutual support. And if one went to war, they all went to war. So that's how we ended up fighting the Germans. That ended up being our major opponent during the war. But we went there because of the Japanese. And so it's amazing how in history gives you a lot of answers. And when you don't have those answers, if you don't get the correct answers, people will come along with certain leadership skills and convince you that they have your solutions and they have your answers. And so, that's one of the keys to being in politics in this country.
So
that you sell somebody some lies for them to buy them.
So when you hear things like what's going on in Florida and other places, parts of the state of Wisconsin, in Florida, they need to examine all the books and basically do away with things that they don't like in the books. And somehow that is American. That makes sense. That we want to.
Most of those people, Earl, are not going to read them books because, you know, a lot of those people, you know, don't understand what it is they're looking at. We got a 7-year-old, you know, granddaughter here, and she's autistic. Brilliant as hell once you figure out how she sees things.
Right.
But the bottom line is that they're sending stuff home about what's a pronoun and what's a common noun and all this other stuff. She's 7 years old, Earl, and she's learning that stuff. She's picking up on it.
Right.
And the thing is that parents, even with, you know, in our household, we got, you know, about eight or nine college degrees in this house, including the PhD. So here we are sitting here struggling with a 7-year-old trying to figure stuff out. And what's happening is that our children are getting smarter. And what's happening is we're going after the books to try to silence them when, in fact, they're getting it from electronic sources. They're not getting it from the books. So you got people out there burning books when they ought to be burning the darn cell phones and stuff on the internet.
Right.
They're going about it the wrong way. But because people like DeSantis has convinced the people in Florida, and keep in mind, Florida has an older population.
Hey, Professor Harvey, got to hold the thought. Professor Harvey, hold the thought. Got to go to a break. Hate to have to interrupt you, but we got to do it. We'll be right back.
Yes, I think I'm going out of my head. Going.